Welcome to Baby Tour Guide's Montessori Babies podcast. I'm your host and baby tour guide, Bianca Solorsino, and for the last decade, I have dedicated myself to helping parents, educators, and caregivers optimize baby development through a Montessori lens. This podcast is all about evolving our Montessori practice to make our time with our sweet babies easier, relaxed, and so much fun. Let's jump into it. Hi everyone, welcome to season 2, episode 26 of our Montessori Babies podcast. Today's episode is really, really special. We have a podcast listener and fellow mama who I just got to chatting with on Instagram, and you know, she sent me some really inspirational stuff. So I asked her if she'd be interested in coming on the show, and she said yes. Her name is Catherine, and she is a Montessori mama to an adorable 11-month-old. Actually, I believe her baby is now 1, but when we first started talking and recording, she was 11 months. So anyway, I am just so, so excited for this episode because I love connecting with you guys. First of all, it's one of my favorite things about this, if not my favorite thing, is getting to know all of you incredible parents out there. But the other thing is we started talking about art. And so that is what today's episode is all about. And she really shares some incredible insight and research into art in relation to child development, in relation to Montessori. And it was just such a fun conversation. So before we jump into that, I first wanted to just kind of reflect on 2023. It has been so wild, so fun. I cannot believe it's already over. It just like flew by. As you guys know, I'm just consistently in awe at how incredible you guys are, and so thankful for you guys and listening to the Montessori Babies podcast and being in this podcast community. And for those of you who joined the course, being in that community, it's so wonderful getting to know you guys one-on-one. And I know you guys are probably feeling something similar, like this year just flew by. I know in early parenthood, you know, you're sleepy and there's so many things happening and so many milestones happen in infancy and toddlerhood just so, so, so quickly. You know, they go from just non-mobile, squishy little newborns to fully mobile, talking, chatting, running away toddlers. So fast. It happens so fast. So I am just thankful to be on this journey with you guys. And I'm just so grateful to be also the mommy to my son. I am having quite literally the time of my whole life and getting to see who he is, what his temperament is, what he's interested in, all of these things. It's just truly an honor. And he's just quite the incredible little guy, you know? Loves helping around the house. He's right in that explosion of language. So he's starting to repeat a lot and just started putting a couple words together and starting to try some longer, harder words, you know, and he's just so funny and loves to dance, and it's just so much fun. And I know you guys are feeling all the same type of stuff with your beautifully unique babies. So anyway, I am looking forward to journeying through 2024 with you guys. Another thing I want to mention for any of you who are interested in research is I have a friend who works for the University of California, Irvine, and they are conducting a research study on early fatherhood. And I believe it's mental and behavioral health and awareness, stuff like that. I don't think that they're actually conducting any sort of research on you specifically. It's more so you're just going to be answering some questions. So the reason I'm sharing this is because you do get a $50 Amazon gift card if you do want to participate. And I think that they're just going to take like an hour and a half of your time over a Zoom meeting. So the requirements to join this study are that you have access to a computer, because you don't have to go anywhere except for that Zoom meeting. You do have to be between the ages of 19 and 39, and you do have to be a father whose female partner is currently pregnant or within the first month or two after birth. They did extend it up to 2 years though. So if you do have a baby under 2 and you know, maybe you and your husband are interested in participating in this kind of stuff, it should be something just quick fun, and you would get, you know, a $50 Amazon gift card out of it. So I sent it to a couple of my family and friends. So it sounds like it'll be kind of fun. And yeah, yeah, the idea is just to improve research about health and behaviors of new and expecting fathers. So anyway, if that interests you, I will have the details in the show notes. You just have to send an email to a lady named Rachel, and I will have her contact info in the show notes. I do also want to clarify that they are looking for participants for 2024. I don't think I mentioned that before. So January, February, March of 2024. So if that interests you, like I said, everything will be in the show notes. So without further ado, let's go ahead and just jump into our interview. So I had the pleasure of interviewing Catherine Cespedes. So she is a nonprofit professional who has worked for the last 17 years supporting children's and young people's education through personal development, college admissions, and early intervention services. So through training from the United Way Center for Excellence in Early Education, she came to work with students ages 0 to 3 in the implementation of early literacy, art, education, and special needs curriculum. She's also committed to social justice and has served as a Take Stock in Children's and Breakthrough Collaborative student mentor and has advocated for both middle school and high school students experiencing personal adversity. So from 2016 on, she's managed undergraduate and graduate student programs in Washington, D.C., focused on service learning and academic scholarship. She also graduated with honors from Dartmouth College's philosophy department, where she specialized in applied ethics and the philosophy of science and religion. So at present, she's a full-time Montessori mom of a one-year-old and is thoroughly enjoying the process of implementing Montessori activities, both indoor and outdoor. So before we hop into our interview with Catherine, I'm going to go ahead and read our quote for the week. So our quote is by Marianne F. Cole, who is a visual artist, and she said, "Art is a place for children to learn to trust their ideas, themselves, and to explore what is possible." And that is just the most perfect quote for this week, and you guys are about to find out why. Let's go ahead and jump into our interview with Catherine. Thank you so much, Catherine, for coming on our show. I am so, so excited to chat with you today.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure and I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, of course. So can you please start by telling us just how you found Montessori as well as what you currently do so our audience can get to know you?
Okay. So the brief answer that I would provide is that in the year 2010, I came across this documentary called Babies, and they follow the lives of four individual children from very different cultures. And that was the first opportunity that I had to observe how indigenous cultures, as well as pastoral cultures, provided with this ample opportunities for open-ended play, for freedom of movement, for lots of interactions with not just the natural environment, but just the people that were in the community. And it was very evident to me as a viewer that that made a tremendous difference in the way that children develop, from everything starting with their mood to their level of curiosity and their level of confidence. So that's where my interest first got picked for a minimalist approach to parenting, as well as open-ended explorations of the environment. And that over the years is what led me to discovering Montessori, because that already became a part of my value system.
That's amazing. First, I love the documentary, the Babies documentary. They showed it to me when I was studying, almost 10 years ago. And it's such a good one. So I could totally see how it inspired me as well. So you have done some incredible research and you have some really exciting things to share. So I'm just so, so excited to jump into that. So do you want to go ahead and start with some of those things, and then I will?
Yes, definitely. So in our initial conversation, I had shared with you that as I was doing a review of art history, I came across this quote that was just absolutely fascinating by Pablo Picasso, that stated that it took him 4 years to paint like Raphael, but a lifetime to paint like a child. And that was extremely thought-provoking for me, because I wanted to know, what did he paint like at the beginning and what did he paint like after, as he's describing that is so complex and something so challenging, something that requires such a high level of mastery and discipline to paint like a child. I was just fascinated by that. So I definitely did some research. And that is where I come across most of the content for the presentation that I'm about to make today. Yeah. So that's a little preface that I wanted to share. Yeah. So it started with a quote and then the research follows.
That's amazing. Quotes are so inspirational.
Definitely. You know, and that's something that I definitely pick up on also in your previous shows, because you usually start with a quote and it's just a beautiful way to introducing concepts and ideas and picking interests that then every individual can take in their own hands and do their own research and arrive at their own individual conclusions. So I think it's so enriching. So that's also the way that I started my journey. Since the conversation is about art and about what makes art unique, I wanted to, as my first point, to just outline a little bit about what makes art unique as a field, you know, that is different from, let's say, mathematics, literature, and many other fields of study. So the first one is that art is an open concept. So philosophers have debated through generations for the definition of art, and even identifying what are the sufficient and the necessary conditions for what constitutes art, but they have never been able to fully nail it down. And part of the reason why is because artists are constantly pushing the boundaries of what counts as art. So because of that, it's a very fluid concept. And like, I'll provide one example. You know, if we come up with a simple definition that for something to be art, it must be beautiful, there will be a counterexample that there is also such a thing as art that is not beautiful, you know, but it's meant to shake up the status quo. It's meant to maybe awaken our sensibilities, because maybe we have become too used to whatever society defines as beautiful, you know, so shake up the floor, you know, so that too counts as art. Or if we say it must be intentional, there could also be a splatter that counts as art, you know, so there's always a counterexample. So that is why it's an open concept. So that's one key attribute about art. Another key feature about viewers of art or consumers of art is that they too, like art as a discipline, they're constantly changing as far as their sensibilities and what they consider worthy of being admired as art. So for a lot of cases, for example, one that I came across, Stravinsky's Firebird. And this was a piece of art that hasn't changed through time. But as time went by, people changed their opinion of it. As time went by, they went from being very upset by what they consider disrespectful or they consider something controversial to later on seeing it as a masterpiece, you know? So that's another feature of viewers of art as well, that they also change their sensibilities and their criteria for gauging what art is.
Wow, that's incredible. It feels so true, like through the lens of the adult, you know, when we're looking at stuff, we have all these kind of biases already, you know, as we get older and such, and then enter the child who just has these, you know, limitless potentialities. And of course, it would be them who show us the beauties within all pieces. So
exactly. And that too takes flexibility in terms of our perception, because we may be looking at an experience. Actually, I came across one that was fascinating, and it was an example from a parent where the parent happened to not like a specific genre of music. You know, they thought they didn't like it for some reason, but somehow they had to silence a little bit of that bias because they had to remind themselves that their child was looking at the experience from a brand new perspective, you know, so they had to be a little bit more neutral to see how their child comes to appreciate it and what they think of it. Maybe they like it, maybe they don't, or maybe they have questions, you know, so that too takes a lot of flexibility.
Absolutely.
Yes. And one other thing that I came across that I very much wanted to share today has to do with studies that have been carried out that identify biases that adults have towards children's art. And I found this very eye-opening because in line with Montessori pedagogy, there is this understanding that the way that we perceive children needs to change, because oftentimes we tend to see them in a very rigid way that may have been colored either by experiences, maybe from other people, or maybe just one brief moment that you saw someone else's child, as opposed to actually having experienced them as a whole person, you know? So this particular study is something that I found quite in line with Montessori pedagogy, and I think actually would be quite helpful to remember as both educators and as parents. So the study asked the question, can someone on training art tell the difference between a child's artwork and an abstract artist's artwork? So because a lot of times parents look at abstract art and they say, hey, my child can do that. That's not that big of a deal. But actually, that ends up being more complex than one might actually first imagine.
Okay.
So in this study, individuals were shown examples of each of a child's work and an abstract artist's work. Mm-hmm. And they were later asked to make a guess. Which one do you think made it? Do you think it was a child? Do you think it was a professional artist? And the finding was that the individuals, as they saw the artwork and they believed that they saw more intentionality or more structure in the piece of work, they were more likely to assign it to an adult artist. Ah. And by extension, they also assumed that if there were traces of unintentionality, they were more likely to believe that the work was done by a child. You know, and that I found very interesting for one reason, that the study has been replicated 6 times and the findings have been consistent. And the key takeaway is that there tends to be an unspoken but ingrained negative bias towards child's artwork. The adults tend to think that children's work is a messier, less complicated version of an adult's work. And that's actually, mm-hmm. as you know, not true. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we're going to discover through the rest of the presentation. But I just found that very interesting because as educators and as parents, it's very important for us to keep that awareness as we face any interaction with a child, that some of our perceptions or preconceptions may have already been colored from before that encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. What it makes me think of is, in what I do, I try to see things kind of through the lens of the child. And it makes me think of how Dr. Montessori said the child has limitless potentialities. And that in this case, it's being expressed through art, you know? And so like, we can see it, we can see, you know, the adult who has all these kind of preconceived notions, and then the child who, you know, doesn't, the child who is just free and going and exploring through art.
Exactly. And this is where I get to exactly in line with what you just said. This is where I get to this second study that to me is far more eye-opening than the first one that I just shared, which is about how children approach art creation in an entirely different way than adults do. So, for example, people in the past thought that child's art was what they call error-prone. They saw it as something to be corrected, and therefore traditional art education was used to focus as a correction exercise to straighten out those errors. And by errors, they meant depicting whatever you see as realistically as possible. But that's something that has changed over time. So, for example, one example of what a traditional educator might have done is when they ask a child, can you draw a face? And they draw something that to the educator doesn't look like a face. They may say, okay, no. This is how you do it. And then they'll actually show it how, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a very outdated approach because in light of the research that has been done on how children approach art, there is a different understanding and therefore a different approach to encountering these learning experiences with children. So yeah. In the progressive era, beginning of the 20th century of education, the new view is that the child is an artist in his or her own right. Mm-hmm. And therefore now what was used to be seen as errors, they're not seen as errors anymore. It's actually being understood to be solutions. And now you may ask, solutions to what? Mm-hmm. It's children's attempt to solve the very real problem of mapping the three-dimensional world onto a two-dimensional surface, which is a piece of paper. So whatever they draw is their proposed individual solution to that problem. And I just think that's pretty earth-shaking.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. That's so cool. It's like how they're conceptualizing and then how they're then using the tool of the hand to describe it to you. That's so cool.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's also been shown that children are not striving for realism to begin with. You know, so the lens that we were using to evaluate their work wasn't the right one to begin with in the past.
Wow.
There has been a psychologist of art that stated the following. Children are seeking for the simplest structural equivalent of an object on a page. So, for example, if the child is asked to draw a face and let's say the body of a person, they may draw a circle and maybe they may choose to put the different body parts in whatever order they choose. Mm-hmm. And if the person asks, why is it that, for example, you place the arm on top of the head as opposed to under the neck? Mm-hmm. The child may answer, I don't really care for the order. I just care that both are shown on the page, you know, so they're mm-hmm. very practical in that way. Mm-hmm. They just show that both or all of the areas that they see are captured on the page. Mm-hmm. And then it's now their prerogative to choose how they put it together, which I think it's totally fine. You know, it's a different way of approaching the representation.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. One of the things that I learned in, as I was mentioning before we started recording, I took an art class in college, and the teacher had taught art to children for a lot of years. So my professor was an art teacher for children as well as for adults. And so one thing that she said, kind of similar to what you were saying as far as how the child is presenting the art, she had said to ask them to tell you about it. Obviously, in infant and toddlerhood, it would be a little bit different, right? Because we're kind of just going to describe and like try to take as much bias out of the language. But like, she would just encourage to kind of have the child explain and, you know, just really kind of vibe with what they're feeling within the piece of art.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's true. And a few other observations that have been made on the way that children make art is that they're also not striving for accuracy. Something that is predominant in the way they approach it is their personal taste, their personal preference and their inner vision. And each child is going to be different. You know, like they may color, and I like this example, they may color the sky green. And someone asks, why do you do that? And they'll say, because I like color green and I think it's beautiful. And I see the sky as beautiful. So that's why I paint it green. You know, and I think that's very original. That shows a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we as adults are more privy to how this works, the more appreciative and the more supportive we can be of their confidence and their process.
Absolutely.
So that's another finding. They're comfortable with multiple perspectives, which is also fascinating. So for example, if there is two people playing board game and they are supposed to draw that, they may draw the two individuals from a profile view, but then they may show the actual board with the board showing up to the viewer. So somebody may say, wow, but you know, that's not how reality looks. You know, the board is not actually standing. And they may say, yeah, but then how else do I show what game they're playing? You know, and as they were doing more research, they also identified that some of these techniques that children use, such as, for example, multiple perspectives that I just described, mm-hmm. has also been used by very famous artists.
If you're a new parent hoping to implement Montessori at home, you may be surprised to know that you will be spending the majority of your days fostering independence with your baby. Yes, even more than the Montessori toys, materials, activities, and furniture that you see on social media. And fostering independence is the easiest and quickest way to transform your parenting experience, bringing peace to your parenting as you optimize your baby's growth during their most crucial years of development. Plus, fostering independence is the most misunderstood Montessori concept for babies. That is why I am teaching my Montessori workshop on fostering independence from infancy to toddlerhood. In this 30-minute workshop, you will learn what it truly means to foster independence the Montessori way, plus you'll get the exact steps on how to foster independence with our non-mobile babies, our sitting, slithering, crawling, and cruising babies, and our young toddlers. This workshop is usually $9, but because my goal is to support you as much as possible, I am gifting it to you totally free. So if you're ready to transform both your experience and baby's experience during their most crucial time in their developmental journey, click the free workshop link in the show notes. And now back to our show.
So for example, artists in the medieval period, as well as Cubist art, that's very interesting because it shows that those that were innovators of their time were willing to take those risks. They didn't have to draw realistically. They could play with perspective just so that they can better represent whatever it is that they have in front of them and make it clear.
That's incredible. And it just ties right back into kind of what the quote that you started with, you know, the taking a lifetime to paint like a child, or as the quote had mentioned, it just is so incredible how their minds work and how the ceiling is just not even there, you know?
Exactly. You know, and then that boundless confidence to just express your inner vision, which I think that as adults sometimes becomes difficult, you know, because maybe we're thinking, oh, what might my employer think, or what might, I don't know, somebody else think, you know, so you tend to edit yourself a little bit more. But children don't have that filter, and that is a tremendous strength, you know, if we can carry that forward, for sure.
Absolutely. When one of the things that I had learned in that one art class is that at some point, some sort of adult, like whether, you know, you're in school or whatever, has said something to deter you one way or another. So like, for example, all children, like, as you know, babies and toddlers, and they will do art and they'll dance and they'll sing and, you know, they'll do all of these artistic expressions and creative outlets. And at some point they're told something like, you're good at it, or wow, or on the other side of it, like, oh, what is that, you know, or something to swing them one way or another. And then you'll find people continue to draw or continue to sing or not. And I think the marker was something like second or third grade or something like that. But yeah, it was really fascinating.
Exactly. Picasso's also known for this other quote about every child is a genius when it comes to art. Mm-hmm. But the key challenge is, how do we retain that artistic genius into the adult stage, you know? And that's definitely the question.
Absolutely.
That's definitely the question. So the key takeaways from this study about what is unique about children's art is that children see art as a problem-solving exercise. They're very pragmatic and individualistic. They are not afraid of multiple perspectives. Their inner greatness is due to cognitive flexibility that they have from the start. And lastly, the realism, and this is a very important key takeaway for anybody. Realism is just one way of putting the three-dimensional world on paper. And it's only one way.
That's amazing. It's so true, too. I mean, it's like through the lens of the person, you know? And our children are so limitless in that sense. So it makes so much sense.
Exactly. So they're the masters of multiple perspectives. So I just found that research very eye-opening, very interesting. And it's also very valuable for us as both parents and educators, because it allows us to foster that independence of thought and independence of expression that children have.
And most people do art with their kids. You know, that's why I was so excited about this episode. We haven't touched on it on the podcast yet. And I think that is going to be really, really insightful to a lot of people who, you know, most parents are just busy, you know, they go throughout their day, you don't think too much of it. So having these tips, I think, are going to be incredibly helpful. So thank you for sharing.
No, and thank you as well for the opportunity. So now I wanted to touch a little bit on to something that is also very powerful to remember as we open ourselves to experiences where we either create art or we explore art, or even we become observers of art. Mm. And that is the values that are inherent in art. And I'm going to touch, I mean, there's endless values, but I'm only going to touch on a few just to get us started as to what some of these powerful values are. So the first one is critical distance. When we see art, we look at it from a distance. And that goes along the lines of, in our minds, we think, okay, well, this event that I see, let's say on a painting or on a drawing, it's not happening to me. It's happening to somebody else. And that critical distance becomes very important as we mature, because it's the basis for intellectual analysis, for example.
Ah,
as we see ourselves as separate from what it is that we're observing. Yeah. And that's something that can very much be fostered through arts education and our exposure to art or art creation. So awesome. Critical distance. The second one is observational powers. So we look. We don't necessarily need to do anything. We just look. And that's rare, because many other disciplines involve us becoming active in some kind of way, either thinking of a solution or coming up with a procedure or coming up with an explanation. Here, you don't need to do anything. You just observe. And that's extremely powerful as well. Even as educators, it becomes powerful, because as we are evaluating the way that we're implementing a curriculum, we also need to observe how individual children react. So that's always, it's also honed through art consumption and creation. Another one is safety. No matter what is shown on the work or how we may feel about it, such as the emotional response, we are safe and our emotions are also safe. So for example, one key example that is provided is that if we look at a painting where there is maybe a scene of war, or there is maybe a conflict taking place, the conflict is not taking place with us. So we are able to observe, and whatever emotions we have about what we see on the painting or on the drawing, it's safe. We can feel, for example, sadness about something we see, or we can feel confusion, or we're not sure exactly, you know, what is going on. We can have a lot of questions. We can be confused. And we learn that those emotions are safe. Mm. We learn to sit with them, because we have the freedom to ask questions.
Yeah, that's powerful. It's a powerful tool. Yeah.
As a child and also as we grow older, as adults, that we don't need to run away from emotions and we can experience the full spectrum and understand it and sit with it. So that's another important value, that safety that comes through art. Another one is choice. We choose what to look at when we go to a gallery or when we enter another space of art creation. We determine how long. We can also choose to turn away. We're in control. So that opportunity to experience power and control and choice is also very much in line with Montessori, for example, where we allow our child to express themselves and we honor their choices as appropriate. Mm-hmm. So that's also another value. Another one is personal power. As one observes, we stand above what we're looking at. And we, at that moment, become agents through choice because we decide what it is that we want to look at. We also decide what we want to create. So we get to experience that personal power through that exercise, either through creation or through observation.
Yeah.
Another one is also emotional attunement or processing, such as, for example, savoring a feeling. We have the range of emotions that I described earlier that can go anywhere from being sad to being happy. We can also experience something called complexity of emotions, such as, for example, being moved, which is a composite of being sad and feeling compassion. We also learn ownership of our emotions because they are highly individual and they're ours. So we learn to own our experiences as well.
Wow, that's incredible. It really feels almost like, first of all, so many of the principles are fluid between what we're fostering in Montessori and kind of what you're saying that these experiences, these art experiences can provide. Another thing that came to mind was that in Montessori, a lot of times there's this idea that it's a little bit more rigid, you know, and that it only focuses on the things within the classroom space and maybe academia and, you know, stuff like that. Like when you think about the Montessori preschool age, which a lot of times is what people first think of when they think of Montessori, you know, so, but it makes me think of how it is limitless, like how these principles are infused into the experiences and how it really can create a very creative child, you know, so. Mm-hmm. So that's something that it made me think of when you were talking about this. So thank you for sharing that.
Definitely. No, I find any reflection about values powerful because it allows you to better assess where you stand in relation to those values. Mm-hmm. And it can even pick your own personal interest as to how to foster that value in yourself and in others. So yeah. I always loved conversations about values. Another value that art also fosters is meaning making. So, for example, it prompts you to ask the question, what does this, whatever the object is, whether it's a sculpture, it's a painting, anything, what does this mean to me? And that is both as a creator and also as an interpreter. So when you look at someone else's work, you have your own interpretation. So you're creating your own personal meaning from what you see in light of your experiences, your values, etc. But also as a creator, you have to reflect on what it is that something means to you and what do you want to bring that vision into reality that others can observe? Why should it be communicated in the first place? You know, so that's very powerful. Self-expression and risk-taking, self-affirmation, and lastly, thoughtfulness. It prompts us to constantly think and to reflect on what it is that we're seeing. So it's a skill that we can apply to any aspects of our lives. Right. Because now as we face any situations, we can constantly ask ourselves, how does this fit into the overall narrative of my life? What meaning am I going to make of this experience? Or what meaning am I going to make of this opportunity? So that's a skill that you can carry through life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now this is actually something that I am going to do my best to abridge simply because it's so rich. And I think that it's something that I'm going to share in one of the resources attached to the show that comes from a book called Studio Thinking from the Start. So it essentially touches on how these values that I just described translate into specific habits that art education fosters in children that changes lives. And when I say changes lives, I'm not speaking necessarily as to how does it affect their academic performance in other areas, or how does it affect their, let's say, test scores or anything like that down the line, but rather how does it change them as a person, as a thinker, as somebody that lives in society and relates to others, and how do they even experience themselves? So that's the value of that. So I'm just going to mention them. I won't go into this, the specific description of each habit. I will just cite the work so that other audience members can also read and follow up on the work as well. One of the powerful habits of mine is called developing a craft. So art allows us to hone on a skill, learn how to use various tools, and work on them until we achieve mastery and proficiency. And that can take years, you know, for almost anything, whether it's an instrument or a paintbrush or painting with oil, like you name it. You know, it's something that takes years. It takes skill, and your personality also plays a big role in that. So that's one big contribution. The other one is it teaches us to engage and persist, because the process is not necessarily easy, and even expressing ourselves can take time. It allows us to develop the opportunity to envision, to have an idea and bring it into reality. It allows us to express ourselves, such as making works that convey personal meaning, such as something that I described in the previous conversation about values. It allows us to develop our observational skills, also allows us to reflect, such as when we talk to students about the work of others. And we also evaluate what has worked in our efforts to bring a vision to reality, what could be improved, and how can we use that knowledge to improve ourselves, and also how others can improve themselves. Lastly, it's also stretching and exploring, such as when we play with different media, and we try new things and make mistakes, and we learn from them. And lastly, the eighth skill is understanding the art world, such as learning what artists do and why they do what they do. So that is something that is valuable for its own sake. And researcher and the author that published this study was very keen on highlighting that art doesn't have to justify itself. And it's something that we can value for its own sake.
Absolutely. I feel like that's a really good tool to have just in general, you know, in life. So it's awesome that, you know, when we, as their adults, as their guides and educators and parents, of course, when we're able to kind of reframe our own minds to kind of view things through this limitless lens, it's really beautiful. So thank you for sharing that.
Just to the very last part, we're essentially circling back for this last segment on Pablo Picasso, the original quote that we started the show with, and his concept of the child as a natural artistic genius, and how this ties in with the progressive era in art education. So to wrap up everything that we have here so far, Pablo Picasso is understood to be a revolutionary in the art world of the 20th century. He's most famous for his role in pioneering cubism, so he was an innovator, and also for his melancholy blue period processes. Going back to the quote, he stated that it took him 4 years to paint like Raphael, but a lifetime to paint like a child. Raphael was a painter and architect of the High Renaissance period, whose work is known for its clarity of form, ease of composition, and visual achievement of human grandeur. And that is because he was very much after beautiful representations of reality. So he was an innovator as far as technique and as far as representation of his period. But now, why is Picasso highlighting the child? Is because he is now opening a new era of innovation in art. A child, as we mentioned, is solution-oriented. He goes for simple representations. The child is confident and unafraid to take risks, is individualistic, takes a preference for their personal taste as well as their personal preference, takes and adopts multiple perspectives, is pragmatic, and has a vast amount of cognitive flexibility. And as we can remember, this was from the research that we had discussed earlier. And the reason why this is so important in light of Montessori arts education is because Pablo Picasso, in his new understanding of the child as the model for what a true artistic genius is that he heralded the progressive era in arts education. It happens to coincide that both happened at the beginning of the 20th century, where he had this insight and realization, but also arts education began to change exactly in tandem during this time. So I just find it fascinating that historically the two movements coincide. Yeah. His view and his existence as an innovator alongside with changes in how our education is approached with children. He also knew long before the research was in that children were different in the way that they approach art making, and they are far superior in their cognitive flexibility, risk-taking abilities, and individuality, which is the essence of artistic genius. Yeah. They were the first because there were so many periods in art in which it seems as it was to a large extent a conversation between different artists. They deviated a little bit from the previous generation, but perhaps they didn't completely break away. Mm. But Pablo Picasso is revered to such an extent because he was one of the few artists that actually led this movement of completely breaking away from tradition and past styles. So children, for example, are the first to break away from the status quo of realism naturally. So they don't even have to go through this period of study and understanding and evaluation and challenge. They just do it naturally. They did it from the beginning, what took adults centuries to discover, which is their creative license. He uplifts the dignity of the child in their creative process, which is a very Montessori insight. Mm-hmm. And he also offers a key reminder to parents and educators about the responsibility to nurture, protect, and develop the natural and innate creative genius of every child, which is a privileged responsibility, a unique opportunity that we have to, and so much to learn from them.
Wow. I think the thing that stood out and it just keeps replaying in my mind is that what constitutes an artistic genius the child has naturally. That is just so, so, so beautiful. So thank you so much for sharing all of that. I love when there's, as you know, I love when there's research to kind of view what we find in relation to the child, how we can, as parents, continue to, you know, evolve alongside our kids. And I think that especially with infants and the idea of limitless potentialities, we have this wonderful opportunity to foster through art, you know, expression and just a really lovely outlet for our children to have for their entire lives. So thank you so much for sharing those.
You're welcome. And this has been fascinating for me, as we said, departing from the quote to the research that backs it up and that adds even greater context. So this has been fascinating for me as a parent.
Thank you for sharing it. So do you have tips on how you can incorporate art? So for the parents that are in our audience, do you have tips for them? And then can you also just share what you're doing with your baby as well?
Yes, definitely. So I think I'm going to go from the unstructured to the structure when it comes to the feedback that I may provide. So from the unstructured, I would say when we are outdoors, honing in your child's sensory capabilities. So that's something that they're already equipped with, and having that very clear opportunity to tune into our five senses is something that provides a bedrock for being able to appreciate art as you grow older. So for example, providing, as you have mentioned in some of the other episodes, for example, visual opportunities, honing your attention on color, brightness, texture. So these are, as I said, very elemental components of what would become a much more rich experience of life and how we perceive our experiences. Okay. So I would start with that, focusing on the five senses and providing opportunities for them in the day-to-day experience. So that's from the unstructured, because that can happen anywhere, outside, indoors. More structure, we can think about the various disciplines in art. We can think of dance as also something that you have mentioned, musical instruments, literature, such as when we read, and using rich sensorial language involving the five senses through any of the works that we use. It can be, I think you may have mentioned actually in your previous episode that one of the activities that you do is that you don't just choose books that are for the specific developmental stage. You can actually explore a little bit further into other types of works that you can adapt so that they can still engage and they can still interact with you. But you are exploiting, you can say, the power of the rich language that you may find in a longer work. So I would say that's also something that you can incorporate that's a little bit more structured, that requires a little bit more research, more materials. One specific resource that I wanted to share is a series called Come Look With Me. And it's about the world of art. and it's by Bank Street College of Education. And okay. they touch on so many topics that you can think of, from African-American art, women artists, exploring modern art, and so forth. And mm-hmm. they ask such amazing questions so that you can start conversation in age-appropriate ways about how what a child sees, how they experience the piece of art, and questions they may have that you may not know the answer to, but together you can explore.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you for sharing those things. I think that's really, really helpful for our parents. Kind of like I mentioned, you know, as you know, the life of a parent is like so busy and stuff, and having these little tips just kind of to pull from is really helpful to kind of enrich their daily experiences. So thank you for sharing those. Okay, so now to kind of end out our show, for a quick rapid fire question, what is your favorite Montessori activity to do with your baby?
So my daughter is 11 months old. She's quickly approaching the 1 year mark, and this is our birthday month. So I'm so grateful that you have me on a month that is so significant for us. This is my birthday and hers as well. Thank you so much. I would say that my favorite activity at the moment is going outdoors and mm-hmm. allowing her to have open-ended play in a variety of surfaces. So, for example, sand when we go to the beach, or grass, or also gravel. So for gravel, I will actually have wear soft sole shoes, but mm-hmm. for all the other ones, she's barefoot. And what I love about that is that not only does it allow her to develop greater strength as far as her body, but also I get to see her confidence. There are times when she has tripped up, and because it doesn't hurt, these are relatively soft surfaces, she looks at me. And when she sees that I'm completely fine with what she's doing, she picks herself up and she goes off running again. And I love seeing that confidence. So for me, this is an experience that I can't fully assign a price on, because it's priceless. It's beautiful to see how she laughs and runs, and she just goes after whatever piques her interest. So learning about nature, learning about how her body feels, and gaining confidence.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you for sharing everything. I know I've learned so much in this show, and I'm sure, you know, the parents who are listening are going to just really have so much fun incorporating the tips and advice that you shared. So thank you so, so, so much, Catherine, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And as I've always said, I admire your work so much. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And that was our interview with Catherine. I hope you guys loved that conversation as much as I did. It was so, so, so much fun diving into that research and just seeing how beautiful art can be for our children. So I will have all of her resources linked below. They'll be in the show notes if you guys want to check out some of the studies she mentioned. And that is about it for today's episode. Thank you guys so, so, so much for listening to this episode of our Montessori Babies podcast. And I will catch you in our next one. Bye. Hey, it's Bianca, your baby tour guide here, hopping back in to say thank you again for listening to this episode of our Montessori Babies podcast. If you found this episode helpful, I would absolutely love if you would screenshot this episode and share it in your stories and tag me at Baby Tour Guide. Also, leaving a review is really helpful in helping other parents and caregivers find our show. Dr. Montessori said, "The greatness of the human personality begins at the hour of birth," and you, as their parent and guide or caregiver, are just the perfect person for that job. I'm so, so honored to be even a small part on your journey. And just remember that we're in this together.